All right, welcome everybody to the post game. I think that was a pretty good show there with Daniel Bessner. Always great to have Daniel on. We got a lot to get to, some fun stuff. We got the return of Alex Jones. Later, we'll have some vintage, actually it's not vintage, only a couple years ago, Leo Panitch, one of my favorite thinkers and writers, who recently passed away, leaving us in a difficult situation to continue that work. We'll also be reaching out to folks in the Discord for questions, so be sure to put those in there. At the Discord, I believe you do, you go into live discussion and ask a question and at Mod, M-O-D, that'll help us get those nice. But how are you hanging, Matt? How's it going?
I'm doing pretty well. You know, I think kind of anxious to see what's exactly happening with the Biden stimulus.
Yeah.
But we don't want to kind of jump into that too much. Just generally, I mean, I love talking to Daniel Bessner, frankly. I think it's fun to talk to people who are both personable and insanely informed. Yeah. That's always a really great combination. Well, so I'm kind of still elated off that.
And I also have the same thing I do like about talking with Daniel is that like a lot of people who are professors, even if they are quite radical, they step away from their kind of radicalness. And I think I love that Bessner can go from being very professorial and sort of going through the, his like my understanding as like a scholar of this, and then to just be like, okay, this is the way that socialists are going to win power, like being very much like a partisan. I appreciate that about him.
Absolutely.
With scholarship. But talking about history, we just faced a pretty historical loss, a loss for posters everywhere, with who I would probably argue one of the greatest posters of all time. And I know, you know, all the disclaimers, honestly, I'm exhausted. I even have to do this. Donald Trump's a pig. We all hate him. You know, he's a right winger and the stuff that he was posting is disgusting. But the guy knew he had that kind of like very particular like brain rot where he was incredible at expressing his bizarre ideas in just a few characters.
I mean, he's a guy. First, there's a couple things about him. So he is the ultimate poster president.
Yes.
He's also the ultimate television president. Like there's these reports of him watching what was happening at the Capitol on TV. And like, I mean, just right. Like he has to have everything mediated and like he gets Fox News to like digest it. Like he's a little baby bird in the morning of like, these are the things I could think like truly a television president, but posted his way to the top. I think.
Like, oh, he definitely posted his way. So like only like we could only all hope for is to get as much success in our life through our posts, through the quality of our posts.
And he had, I mean, he's not just a buffoon. This guy knows media. I mean, he's been calling newspapers as his own publicist for a quarter of a century at this point. Like he's understand this is what he knows actually. And that's literally like why he was able to win, I think, the presidency.
But he's like, he's not only the greatest TV president, but he also is just like, he's the greatest TV president on both sides. Like he had to sit down in front of the TV to get anything, to understand any concept. It had to be on television, on Fox and Friends for him to get it. And he also understood how important it was for him to be on constantly covered on the television. I mean, very much the first true like postmodern president where it's like the image that's most important is the digital one, or at least the one that's coming to you through your screen.
He was literally touting the images of intercoastal water boat parades as evidence that he was looking strong in the election.
Yeah. I mean, that was I know those are the best parts of the Trump meltdown since he lost is like, look at all these posts. Look at all these people who are posting in favor of me. How can you say that I didn't win the election? Look at all these retweets.
And like from a guy who was born in like the fucking 30s or whenever Trump was born, I can understand why that many boats might be exciting. Like, there's something about like, that's probably a bigger flotilla than like minor naval battles of history that we know about. Some of those, like the Lake Travis one where they literally created a whirlpool.
Yeah, they're actual casualties. You know, and died, but some boats were lost.
Casualties.
Some great, beautiful boats were lost.
And you know, I mean, there's, I think we can go through some tweets. I have one I want to nominate.
Yes.
It's one we've brought up a number of times. But I mean, just the thing about it is like the way that we talk about like presidential rhetoric and, you know, how messages are crafted. Trump didn't give a shit about any of that. He was really like going on instinct, which is frankly better than consultants can And so he, this Woodward book comes out, which is, I think this was September 2018. So right, leading up to the midterms. And Trump gets on, and rather than just ignoring it, or maybe even more savvy, is focus on something that's more advantageous to bring up than like whether or not you call Jeff Sessions a dumb Southerner, for instance, like, and just maybe ignore that part. Trump just goes right at it. And here is, I think, my tweet that really is like, wow, I am happy to be following this guy in a very perverted kind of gross way. But Trump says, "The already discredited Woodward book, so many lies and phony sources, has me calling Jeff Sessions, quote, mentally retarded and, quote, a dumb Southerner. I said neither. Never use those terms on anyone, including Jeff. And being a Southerner is a great thing. He made up this divide."
It's, I mean, so
unbelievable
good.
That, like, I always forget, like, the, quote, mentally retarded thing, but do people really doubt that Trump has never called anybody mentally retarded?
Are you kidding me?
Like, this is the guy that did the, I don't remember about that reporter. In
oh,
the,
yeah, that was so disgusting.
He's a complete, like, he's completely disgusting about people.
Well, Trump was more worried about the Southerner thing.
Right.
Because he understands where he's going to, like, need to be currying favor over the next few years. Honestly, this is something that probably is not coming across your radar, but there's a real big kind of dust up in country music right now, particularly with the country music wives. You know, most of these guys, I mean, you know, a lot of those guys, the wealthy ones, are, you know, fairly right wing, but they don't post about politics, right? They're like, oh, I just play guitar, I just tell stories, which is complete BS. And, you know, I cover this with Ben on his podcast, Give Them an Argument, where I go through the real radical history of country music. So this kind of nonsense about this music not being political, it's just complete BS. But anyways, what is really funny is, even though these guys, they don't do political commentary, their wives do. And their wives share these hilarious, like, Q memes and nonsense like that, which get them in big hot water. Jason Aldean's wife is, like, you know, getting him into a lot of trouble now because, you know, she was posting all this, you know, Q stuff and, like, oh, you know, Joe Biden didn't win the election, live tweeting from a vacation in, like, the Dominican Republic or something like that, the storming of the Capitol, and, you know, claiming it's Antifa, stuff like that. And it's very funny. Anyways, I say that because Trump really knows, like, he needs to get in good with the Nashville set for his next chapter.
I mean, bro, you lost Georgia. Maybe things like that had some kind of, I mean,
no doubt.
Do people in the South really think Trump respects him?
Well, that's the thing that always cracked me up about the Trump thing. I mean, I got to say, one of my buddies who's from, like, pretty rural Western Pennsylvania, like, called it from the second Trump went down the escalator. And I had my doubts because I was like, man, if there's anything that, like, most people in the South, in particular the parts of the South that I'm from, Texas being one thing, but South Carolina in particular, hate more than a Yankee is, like, a New York Yankee. And somebody who, like, identifies exclusively as that, I will say I was taken aback at how quickly people were willing to forgive, like, the ultimate sin, which is being, like, a New York billionaire Yankee. So I will say, but, you know, but Trump does a great job at sort of playing the play. I mean, it's a parody. It's a joke, but he just, like, acknowledges him. He's like, I love you, right? Stuff like that. That he did,
you know, and the ban that Trump is really, really probably upset by is not the Twitter one. I mean, that's definitely like was a priority for him. However, the PGA Tour saying we're not going to do events at your golf courses anymore is
so funny
to me.
You know, he was so excited. He's like, I got two more years. I got to be president for a couple more years, and then I'll get to host the PGA tournament.
I mean, like, I wonder if he looks back, he's like, I could have just been a milquetoast president, and then I could have had my retirement where I am a dignitary ex-president and have golfers come to my places. And he fucked it up.
Yeah.
He fucked it up by being, Too racist for the PGA Tour is pretty,
That's pretty exceptional when you show that, like, these clubs literally, like, just, like, desegregated, like, in the 2000s. But we can't forget about these tweets because we need to archive these. forever. I have to apologize to everybody. This website that I'm pulling tweets from is really stupid. One thing that I didn't prepare myself for when they, I didn't realize when they, banned Trump off of Twitter, was that it was going to be really hard to find Trump tweets. We're going to have to go to secondary sources for everything. So we need to make sure we don't forget these gems. I want to start, on memory lane, my waltz down it. On November 10th, 2012, where Trump proclaims something that I think he has proven. Donald Trump, thanks. Many are saying I'm the best 140 character writer in the world. It's easy when it's fun.
Right. Yeah, you know, it is interesting. Like, we remember Trump as the presidential tweeter, but he was obviously such a massive social media guy before
that. Oh no, he was a must follow before this. I mean, here's some other ones. I won't even put them up just real quick. This is another 2012. It's Friday. Just starts it off with this. It's Friday. How many bald eagles did wind turbines kill today? They are an environmental and aesthetic disaster.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. That's the other reason he won is he has a direct line into the old dumb boomer brain that loves all these like chain email arguments against environmentalism and stuff like that.
It's so good. And then, I mean, you know, there's the classics, the Robert Patterson once, with what's
Robert
name?
Pattinson. Yeah.
Ron Pattinson. Yeah.
What's her name? Like
Kirsten Stewart, right? Right, how she's like, where he's like, don't let her, don't take her back, she'll cheat on you again. It's just really funny. And honestly, like, I'm sure.
And never really changed. Like, he's still
never changed. But also, celebrities. Like, I have to say, like, I'm sure for these celebrities, like, they're used to people just like fixating on their life. But it must be really funny to sit here today and be like, yeah, you know, 8 years ago, Donald Trump was like giving me a relationship advice on Twitter, like looking out for my happiness.
Yeah, after watching like Entertainment Weekly and being inspired or
something.
Dude,
it's TV. Like, the thing is, like, what Donald Trump did, I think that was so incredible, is that he brought that like old man mentality. He was a direct line from the television to Twitter, right? Where Twitter, like, so much of it today is very separate from like the cable news variant of American culture. Trump was a direct line feed into that.
Yes. I mean, I remember when I was at NYU studying media and technology, there was all this talk about the second screen, which meant that you had your TV on, but you're also watching it with this thing. And Trump completely is like, oh, I'll have that. That's how I'm going to go become president, basically. Because it's like, we'll get these people and we're going to have me on my, for some reason, all these networks are going to cover my speeches because I say, like, you know, Jeb Bush is low energy and Ricky Rubio has a small dick. And then that's also going to drive engagement on this stuff. Like, I mean, he second screened himself to the presidency.
Oh, 100%. Well, you know, just a couple more honorable mentions before we get to my all favorite. And it's a little bit of a artisanal tweet by Trump that I really like. But I do really like this good one from the presidency here. Tariffs. Let me try. Tariffs are the greatest. Either a country which has treated the United States unfairly on trade negotiates a fair deal, or it gets hit with tariffs. It's as simple as that. And everybody's talking. Remember, we are the piggy bank that's being robbed. All will be great.
And it was. He was right. That's all it took. His tariff stuff worked out. I mean, what was the record on his tariff?
They were disastrous because so much confusion, and they really, really hit U.S. manufacturing, because a lot of our, you know, like first level, like manufactured, so like not just like raw materials, but things like the first level of manufacturing before it gets finished here are done in China and then shipped over here. It created a nightmare for those folks for a really long time. They were disastrous economic policy, but I just love that he thought this was like the one secret negotiating tactic. I love calling the United States everybody's piggy bank.
That's what he's been doing for decades too, right? Like, that's what he, when you see these old blogs from 2008 where Trump's in his office, like talking into a shitty microphone, and it's him talking about how we're getting screwed in like foreign markets.
And everybody's talking. Everybody's talking.
Everyone thinks we're a joke.
What did you have any more that you wanted to put in there?
No, I think that's I kind of just wanted to emphasize the mentally retarded dumb song.
Well, the last two that I'll put in there are just, it was my favorite genre of Trump tweet. And it's one that's very recent. It was in that weird time where, like, you're getting all these different messages from Trump where he was, like, one, denying the pandemic and then also saying it's very serious, like, constantly, you know, changing his position every day. But then in the middle of it would just tweet in the afternoon, social distancing, in all caps, exclamation mark. It was just, like, the perfect tweet, just out of nowhere. That was great. I also love presidential harassment. My favorite Trump tweet of all time is that genre, is like the two word, all caps, exclamation point, just no context. Just because he knew that we were all living in his reality show and would be able to fill in the context for him.
I lied. I you reminded me of one, which is the very illegal and very cool tweet.
Do you have
that? I have it right here. Which I don't even, is it about Russia or something? Let's see.
I can't remember.
But here is it. We'll read it together. Oh, I get it. I am a very good developer, happily living with my wife, when I see our country going in the wrong direction, to put it mildly. Against all odds, I decide to run for president and continue to run my business. Very legal and very cool. Talked about it on the campaign trail.
I think that might be it. I think that might be the best. Very legal and very cool.
Because very legal and very cool, like, that will live on, I think, even better than, like, Covfefe.
Covfefe sucks.
Yeah,
exactly. I hated that the second it came out. I never thought that was funny for a moment. Right.
Yeah, or hamburgers or those misspelling ones.
Hamburgers.
Very legal and very cool is, like, because that's Trump. That's the machine humming at its, like, highest RPM, I feel like.
Oh, yeah.
Like, okay, he's an idiot and will occasionally misspell coffee.
But I mean, only a complete grifter would combine those two words. Like, only somebody like Trump would think of those two things in the same sentence.
Yeah. I mean, total nutcase. Look, you gave the disclaimers off the top of head. It was disgusting when he is doing the rise up against fucking governors.
He was a pig. He said absolutely disgusting stuff. I mean, you know, it's just like, it's very clear. He used that platform to just, like, turn a bunch of people into complete zombies.
Ruined lives, I think, honestly.
There's no doubt about
it. Alienated people from their families.
I mean, I'll never forget. I took a trip up north in New York State, which was a really interesting experience. And I don't know if it was just a cultural difference, because it's like, I've lived all over the South, both in, like, rural areas and, like, urban areas. And I feel very comfortable in most places. You know, again, that's, like, because I'm a white guy and I fit in or whatever. But I had never felt more just strange than I did in, like, upstate New York. And I remember going into this, like, country bar and just seeing this old man just completely covered in Trump gear, just drinking a beer by himself, Trump hat, Trump shirt, Trump jacket. And just thinking to myself, oh, and he had, like, a VFW hat too that had Trump written on. And I just can't remember. And, like, look, whatever, you know, U.S. imperialism aside, like, this is a guy who, like, fought, right? Or, like, seen something in his life, right? And it's just sitting here as, like, at the end of his life, just worshiping this just disgusting queen from New York City, this real estate developer who just, like, does not care at all about him. And it made me, like, it made me just really sad, honestly, to see and think about.
Yeah.
Which I know, like, again, like, I'm sorry, I'm not saying this is not the most sympathetic character in the world or anything like that. I'm not trying to give sympathy to Trump supporters. I'm just watching, like, a historical and cultural moment that, you know, has caused people to do really bad things, and they should be judged for them and, like, you know, seen as people who are willingly acting in that. But that doesn't mean that it's just not, like, a sad fact of history. That's just, like, it's just a sad way to go out. It's just a pathetic way to go out, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I've personally witnessed instances of particularly, like, Catholics, people I'm from, where, like, literally the younger generations will be like, what the fuck are you doing in agreement with the goddamn Pope in terms of politics? And the older generations literally, like, are more concerned with what Trump thinks by far than what the Pope thinks. And it's, I mean, you talk, like, that's the, I think the damage I hate from this shit is the people that are just separated from just ideologically because they're pawns, because of, you know, a political party wants to lie about an election, or, I mean, it goes beyond this election, but like just generally disinformation. And yeah, I agree. Like I understand the lack of patience with sympathy towards those people, but I also see it myself.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
It's bizarre. I mean, it's
yeah, it is.
You talk about how like all the projection about how the right wing, like I frankly have no problem talking about Black Lives Matter to like the generation above me at home. Like, it's not alienated me from people at all. I mean, maybe certain people have, and my family's not like right wing bought into like Hannity, for instance. But yeah, I don't know. That projection is because that's what happened. That's what right wing media is doing to people on a massive scale.
And it's sad. I mean, it's sad too, when you see people who just completely bought up this like Russia fantasy narrative too. Like I've seen people who are just on a completely different spectrum. I remember seeing at family's member's house, I can't remember the way the poem went, but it was like a super liberal thing. It's like, in this house, like we believe Hillary Clinton, we love Madame Albright and Margaret Thatcher. And it's just like, this is just like the most wildly incoherent political statement.
Yeah.
That I've seen it in a while. And it's like, man, that's sad too. Like, y'all are smart people and are better than this and should recognize that. First of all, these people aren't even on the same side of the political spectrum. And these are the people who are actively screwing you and making your life worse. And you're venerating them as heroes. You know, when I say that about the old guys, like the whole thing just makes me, a little sad personally when I see stuff like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Speaking of, honestly, this is a good transition. Speaking of people who have a difficult time, keeping up with reality, I will be honest with folks. I have not kept up with this season of the Alex Jones show. So somebody's going to have to fill me in on all of the lore. But we have a pretty interesting development here. It's a clip from Twitter that somebody pulled with, Alex Jones losing his mind over the Q folks. And before we put it on, honestly, that doesn't surprise me at all, because Q's coming for his grip, right? Q is something that he doesn't control. But I have to say, it is very funny to see a couple crackpots going at it.
Yeah.
Hey, you broke all that. We know that. I'm saying Q tells us stuff and all of it's lies, is what I'm saying.
You keep interrupting me.
Because you're lying! Because you're full of shit! That's why, because every goddamn thing out of you people's mouths doesn't come true. And it's always, oh, there's energy, and oh, now we're done with Trump. You said he was the Messiah. You said he was invincible. You said it was all over. They were all going to Gitmo. Now, oh, he's part of a larger thing of Q. I will not suffer your Q people after this. I knew what you were day one. I know what you are now, and I'm sick of it. I'm sick of all these witches and warlocks and pumpkin popsums and everything. Oh, God. Sorry. You can't talk to you anymore. Jesus, Lord, help me.
Oh, my God.
You broke all that?
From what I've seen of Alex Jones lately, I mean, it was always unhinged, but it's just like a complete free-for-all at this point.
And what's funny about like the Q stuff is that I have seen QAnon Anonymous talk about this a little bit, and it won't be a significant portion because I think it's juiced, frankly, by partisan allegiance to Republican Party, but there will be a not insignificant number of Q people, they predicted, that will follow the new sort of revision that Joe Biden is actually working with Trump and Q, and that Trump has passed along orders to him, because they can't be wrong, right? This is why, like, when the mass arrests never happened. This is why what Matt Crisman was doing was so great with the Q people, which is that he was basically saying, make a testable prediction that will happen, because it's obviously just a millennial, millenarian, end of the world type of conspiracy theory cult.
But I think that's 100%. And obviously Q is just completely bonkers. I think you posted something or retweeted something the other day. I was trying to see if I could find it, but I can't. About searching for the, for the phrase on Twitter, like acting weak when you are strong.
Oh, right.
You know, which is basically like now the Q mantra, which is like that Donald Trump is acting weak, even though he's strong. And it's always, I mean, you know, I have people I know who are really deep into this rabbit hole, unfortunately. And it's amazing to see the kind of posts they do on social media. It's all just like, just wait. And it's like, oh, just wait until December 11th. Just wait until, you know, December 31st. Just wait until January 6th. Just wait until next week. It's always just like, it's, you know, it's like waiting for Godot. It's like, it's never going to happen. You know, and obviously cause it's a grift. But there's a part of it that's like, again, not defending Q, but it's just like, there's a part of it that is, you know, it's people treating politics like a soap opera, which most people do. And most of our media system has taught people to expect, pick your reality, choose your favorite people, and you just live your own life. Right. And you just don't think about politics as something that you can like really directly interact with. And I think a lot of those Q people, who stormed the Capitol last week, learned that lesson the hard way, as we were talking about in the main show today. All these people saying, oh, I was just joking, or I didn't realize this, you know, I thought this was supposed to, you know, this was just an event. This was just like a rally. This is just like a fun activity, that, you know, that we're doing, because there really is a disconnect, for most people's like political consciousness and political media from like the actual political reality of the fact, like, oh no, actually you can't storm the Capitol in a mob without having kind of consequences. And there really is a separation there. And Q extenuates and like amplifies that kind of disconnect between like media and reality. But it's not unique to Q, is more what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like stressing, to the extent I want to get into like issues of censorship, is like what happened at the Capitol didn't happen because all these people have new electronic platforms that they can get radicalized.
Yeah.
Like this happened because the party is lying. Like, it's not like, oh, where did they get this idea? That it's because there's people literally in Congress that, like, of course it wasn't going to shift. It wasn't an actual opportunity to, you know, change the results of the array of power, right? In the last election, right? It was never going to get there, but they still had people fundraising off that. I mean, Ted Cruz himself put out a fundraiser, a Stop the Steal fundraiser. I believe it was a Stop the Steal.
Oh yeah. No, he did.
Along the same lines and same afternoon. So I think there is almost too much focus on, and I hate it. I know people who are like, yeah, my sister is into QAnon stuff, and it sucks. And I do think like the social media networks are responsible for that. At the same time, like, that's a symptom of rot at the top.
No, it's the same kind of brain rot that we got when liberals were saying the opposite about social media. Oh, look at social media. It's leading to revolutions in Egypt, right? It's leading to this, to the Arab Spring, which was BS from the start. That was a complete colonial narrative, first and foremost. But the secondary narrative was this idea that tools make history, not people, which is just fundamentally wrong. And it's this kind of escapism that a lot of these folks are leaning into with social media. It's like, no, the social media didn't create the rot. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, no, yeah, essentially we just have like, you know, we have very fast communication systems. Yes, that changes the way that we interact with each other. Yes, that changes the way that we can spread information. But the systems at play, the people creating those tweets or interacting with that, live in the same society and reality as all of us. So all the actions that they're doing are reflections of that society. And you really give yourself a get out of jail free card if you're going to sit here and say like, oh, well, actually, if Facebook just had more fact checkers, I mean, give me a break with that stuff too. We've been on the other side of that for years before they even started policing as regularly as they do now. These people are not neutral, right? So one, you don't want to give these people that kind of power in the first place. But two, it's a cheap out to think that if we dealt with a social media problem, that we wouldn't have this just complete delusion in our political world. I'm sorry. They just like, one is not, technology is not creating that delusion.
On the demonetization and algorithm tip, did you see Doug Lane was on Cumtown?
No, I didn't.
So Zero Books got a strike. People should go follow the Zero Books YouTube channel. He got a strike for some bullshit about Doug Lane did a thing about, and it was a response to like these great, and we've got to be careful talking about this ourselves, about the COVID great reset conspiracy theories, and you know that the, like basically like English royalty wants to use it to like cut population into a third. And Doug Lane is like, well, this is the real one, basically like a shock doctrine, right? This is what to look for in terms of a capitalist shock doctrine. And they gave him a strike on that for COVID denialism,
Oh my God.
Which is horrible. And and it got reviewed, and the review didn't take either. So now Zero Books is one strike away from getting removed from a channel as a channel. And like, I agree that that there something needs to be done about COVID disinformation. But I mean, you see it like immediately what happens when that these companies that got way bigger than they could have ever hoped to actually like respond to these issues in any kind of way, like with any kind of justice. And so, yeah, that, I mean, it happened after 2016, you saw massive corporatization of YouTube. And it happened, I think again, even after 2018, and you're going to definitely see it again. So patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Yeah. Wait, just on that real quick. Can I just tell, I remember this was at like the height of this stupidity. You know, I was living in Washington, DC in 2016, and DuPont Underground was the gallery. There's an art gallery that put out calls for submissions for a show. And it was such a great encapsulation of just like the pathetic rationalizations that so many neoliberals had in the wake of Trump. So the idea for the show was to have a perfectly fact-checked show, right? So every... it was a general prompt, but it's like everything in the show has to be fact checked, right? So basically, you know, you just have like beautiful maps of the world, you know, showing the effects of global warming that have been looked over by, you know, a climate scientist. I mean, who knows? I'm not an artist. I want to be submitting to it, but it was just such a stupid idea for a show. Such an insecure idea for the show that like, not only do I think that's just going to be shitty art, but on top of it, it's just like, the refusal of so many liberals, and by that I'm talking primarily about, you know, Democratic Party members, who just they couldn't rationalize or understand why that they lost that election, but then they also wanted like this kind of like big other, like the referee to come in and actually say like, no, we're going to fix American democracy. Donald Trump's not allowed to be president because he got this and that wrong, right? They wanted this kind of like mediator to come in and like negotiate and stop any kind of political debates from happening, which I just think is such a terrible political inclination to have.
Fact checking is a symptom of the hollowing out of newsrooms.
Yes.
Like what it is, and I can say this as a fact checker. I fact checked at fullfact.org in London in 2012. And what you do when you are a fact checker is you put the work onto some other body that has done the work before you. So for instance, the Medicare for All fight when Bernie was running, there was this big brouhaha because CNN started citing Koch-backed think tanks and saying that's going to be really expensive when actually that research said that it might save $2 billion based on being better, right? Do you remember this fight I'm talking about? And so like what, and the think tank that made the research is like, oh yes. I mean, we can't really refute what Matt Brunig is saying about it being technically cheaper overall, but that's not the way our research was meant to be used. So CNN goes by like, well, this is what the fact checking authority that I'm based on. Like it is really just, in the UK, it was, you could ask parliamentary questions and they would have a research staff get back to you with governmental information in an interesting way that was actually pretty helpful. Or it's going to these supposedly unbiased outside organizations and using their credibility. So you don't have to use your own because you don't have the newsroom to back up your reporting.
Yeah. You muted yourself, Matt.
Oh, let's see. Should we do some Biden stimulus stuff? Do you have any reaction there?
Yeah.
Do you want to cover that maybe more
tomorrow? I'll probably cover that a little bit more tomorrow. But, you know, just for folks, who are seeing this, like, what is it? We have, it's a $1.9 trillion. Let me pull up some of the numbers I had. $1.9 trillion plan. There's going to be some, important developments, I think, like as we were talking about earlier, providing more funding for city and state governments, providing extending unemployment insurance benefits, extending the eviction moratorium, which I just think is disgusting that that's even something up for political debate in a moment like this, and providing some kind of modest help to renter programs, along with extensions to the earned income tax credit, and also credits for people who have children. I think that will also like you won't have to pay into it to get that back out. Because what happens with a lot of those credits is like for people who don't make a lot of money, if they didn't have to pay $3,000 in taxes from the get-go, they don't get that money back. They're going to change that. And I think he also demanded $15 an hour. So again, these are fine.
Got to get rid of the filibuster. Got to get rid of the filibuster if you're going to do the $15 minimum wage to name, a single one. To be specific to that one, I think. So
yeah, we're going
to
see more on that. We're going to see that. We also have obviously just the joke of the fact that they're going to give people $1,400 instead of $2,000. The fight's very clear. We need to be giving people $2,000 a month, each month, instead of just one-off payments like this. And obviously the solution to this health crisis is to provide people with Medicare for all. The fact is it's wildly inadequate. I think that it's not the worst plan. It's better than the plan that we got from the initial Republicans in response to COVID. My biggest thing right now is let's see what happens as this develops. Because if we know one thing about Joe Biden is he ain't a fighter. He's not somebody who's really gonna, dig deep and push back against a Republican onslaught that is just coming, and it. He's one who's already saying that he's going to leave the door open for them. So we'll see what they're able to develop, over the next couple of weeks. But again, this country is in crisis. We need radical help much more than this plan gets. But even for this plan, we need to be prepared to fight. And hopefully we can get folks who are standing up and ready to go. I know Bernie Sanders has come out saying that he supports the plan, which is great. I know that Biden also has left the door open. This is a first round and not a final. AOC has already come back and pushed back, say that it needs to be $2,000 flat, not $1,400 like they're saying it's going to be. But yeah, we'll get some more information and see what we feel about that.
Yeah, let's move to North Dakota news.
Yeah.
I've got a North Dakota representative from Newtown, North Dakota, which I'll explain the name of Newtown in a little bit. But guy Terry Jones, North Dakota representative, in a story today, says that America.
Sorry, he just looks funny.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's the most up-to-date photo they have, I guess. North Dakota rep, and speaking of up-to-date, we'll see where he gets his information on this stuff. North Dakota rep wants American as race option on forms, says blacks, quote, glad their ancestors were brought here.
Jesus.
So, very racist guy saying, Jones, a Republican from Newtown, said he is disgusted with how race is used by bad actors to divide the country and that his legislation would help unify Americans under a shared identity. So I guess he wants everybody just forget.
Oh, so everybody.
I mean, look, this. And so let me just go right to where he's getting his information from, because I think it will explain why it's. Jones says he believes in this sentiment because he read a Reader's Digest from the 1980s in which a black doctor visited an African country. Just an African country during a period of civil conflict and made remarks about being grateful his ancestors had been taken to America. Forum News Service's attempts to find the article were unsuccessful. Now, that's they had so good. Another a Republican, a black Republican, Michael Coachman, say come out to his defense, saying that not a good defense, I'll say, saying that basically some of those black people probably it was good for them to become Christians. So that's.
Their souls were saved. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
That's where the black Republican from North Dakota is coming from. And just a note on Newtown, where this guy's from. As I mentioned in the first show, about the hydroelectric dam projects that basically flooded native land up and down the Missouri. Newtown is a new town from the 1950s because of exactly the Fort Berthold Dam flooded. I mean, just in like the Mandan Indians, Arikara, Hidatsa lands that were like central to, I mean, even American myths of conquest, like Lewis and Clark, right? Like these were the tribes where they spent the winter with. And they just came like, we need this for hydroelectric power. We're going to flood you. And then we'll make this brand new town called Newtown. And we're going to cultivate bigots like this fucking weirdo who the most updated thing he has to inform his race policy is the 1980s Reader's Digest. And it's funny. And it also disgusts me as a North Dakotan.
Oh, yeah.
Who like, you know, wouldn't mind having, you know, I'd like it to be more comfortable for me to travel there, you know, with certain people that I want to go there with. And that, like, this is the state of it is like, my God. And Michael Coachman, the Black Republican that said that, well, they became Christians in the New World. Like, fuck off. I just want to shout out Black Lives Matter organizer Jamal Abigaz, who has been standing up to some of this stuff locally, because it's really, really disgusting, the state of, like, just the cultivated, just out-of-touch, most aggressive whiteness that is prevalent there. Is, I mean, and in a place that, like, Newtown is really disgusting.
It's just such a funny, like, mentality, too, that, oh, yeah, if we just change the boxes that people check, then we'll forget about historical injustice and all these things. I mean, you know, it is interesting, you know, the United States is actually pretty unique, I believe, for all of the racial categories that, like, we use in official documents and census. I don't think that that's the case in a lot of European countries. Like in France, for example, I don't think that you click, you know, when you get social services, if you're, you know, Hispanic or white or whatever there. You know, and there's, you know, it is an interesting and unique and very American thing too. But, you know, race has been so integral to the American system that it makes sense from a progressive standpoint, like why we use some of these categories. But honestly, this guy isn't trying to push for some kind of, you know, progressive reimagining of politics. He's coming up with just like the most homespun. I love it, honestly. I mean, sorry, I know it's difficult for you, but it's like, right, it's very funny to me, like the most homespun kind of solution to the problem of racial tensions in this country.
And then as his warrant, it's this Reader's Digest that I can't find from the 1980s.
From 40 years ago.
I mean, look, we have the internet in North Dakota. We have television, like, and we have like posts that like survived the 80s. Like, Jesus, this should not be, unfucking believable.
It really is.
That's what you cite.
The gospel came to me in the Reader's Digest. All right. Well, should we do one? Let me try to make sure, because I know we've been going for a little bit. I want to make sure we get to these Discord questions. Do you mind if we do this Leo Panitch thing?
Yeah, sure.
Briefly, because I'd like to clip this. So Leo Panitch is one of the great minds in socialist thought. And, you know, I mentioned this after he passed away on this show. I didn't know him personally, but I have seen him speak before. And I know many people who have known him personally and also have been taught by him. Our friend Adam Proctor was one of his students. For example, he's obviously Leo Panitch was Canadian, but spent a lot of his time working on both Canadian politics and labor politics, a really great theorist of parliamentary politics and of a socialist alternative to what had happened, a critic of neoliberalism and of globalization. And he's somebody, I guess, you know, to get to the point, whose insights are really important. And he's somebody who we lost too soon. So I'm going to try my best to find, you know, good clips of his talks for us to be able to watch on the show over the next few weeks. But this one right here, I don't know if you have it ready, Matt. I just want to set it up real quick. This is, I believe, from 2019. So it's very recent. It's a really interesting talk. I'll post it on Twitter after this, because, you know, it's going back to that time when we thought Sanders and Corbyn might be on the cusp of something. And now we're on, you know, in a different moment. But in particular, one of the things that he highlights in this talk is the move from, protest movements to politics as one of the most important shifts that he saw over the last 10 years of left socialist history. Because you have to remember, there was a really dark time in the left when they thought, oh, we don't ever need to come into power. We can just protest. We can make politicians like do what we want. And what you saw from that was just decades in the wilderness. And then also was the disastrous move to, reject class, or at least to not focus on it, which also led to, just complete destabilization of the left socialist movement. But in this talk, he's primarily talking about globalization and the betrayal of the Democrats to the working people of the United States, and also the Social Democratic parties, and bringing this in. But pay attention at the very end, because he makes a really important point about politics, political parties, and class consciousness, and how they function in composing classes that I want to jump off on after this.
Republican parties. Insofar as after the crisis, social democracy and the Obama-led Democratic Party went back to fostering globalization and financialization, this finally led to the loss of a significant portion of their working class base. In the United States, working class communities, which had unfailingly voted Democrat every election since the 1930s, and voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012, suddenly turned to vote for this political shyster, Donald Trump. And did so because he alone was speaking in terms of the working class, its insecurities, and of course overlaying that with the mendacious, xenophobic, anti-immigrant, racist appeal. And the Democrats, as social democracy in Europe, were largely naked in the face of this. Not because they weren't liberals. Not because they themselves were inherently racist. Precisely because they had abandoned that class base in promoting globalization. The story is well known from one country to another. And it's seen most startlingly, if we go back to what happened after World War I, in the fact that the German and Swedish Social Democratic parties, the Austrian Social Democratic Party, the great mass working class parties that came out of the formation of working classes from 1880 to 1920, right, are now running at something like 20% or less of the vote. It's an astonishing deformation politically, a very historically significant one, and tragically it has a lot to do with class deformation. It has to do with, just as classes are formed over time, so are they deconstructed over time. Especially insofar as that political parties play a role in forming classes, so have they historically undermined class formation.
That's good right there. I really wanted to hammer home that last point that Panitch makes. And I know it's a little bit of a long clip, but that last point that he makes is really crucial. And I think you can't do it without the context beforehand, that political parties play a role in class formation in the sense that a socialist party, or hell, even a social democratic party, or at some points under FDR, there was a class consciousness that came with politics. There was a kind of politics that was, developed through political parties and through activists and through social movements that had people recognize themselves not just as voters who were voting for a particular slate, but members of a political class. What you've seen in the United States in particular, but also all across the world, particularly in Western Europe, but we're also seeing the same things that are happening in India right now, for example, with the rise of this disgusting nationalist politics, is that when you had these left parties, these social democratic parties, right, we can argue about whether, how true it was for the Democratic Party in this country. But when you had those parties reject class as their basis, and fill in another signifier, another idea into it. They vacated that space, and that led in large parts to the decomposition of class. Not in an actual experience of the fact that there are working people in this country and people who own the means of production, people who are bosses who benefit from this exploitative system, but in the kind of political sense where people recognize fellow workers as members of the same class, members of the same political community. When you lost that composition that came through and was mediated through politics, you enter into the wilderness. And you have from the Democratic Party in the United States just a complete rejection, not only of working class people materially, but also in substance and style, right? What you have instead is, you know, slick lawyers and the urban professionals. And that allows the right wing to step into the class debate. People mistake what Trump did, and I think people mistake what Trump did as being the guy who's doing working class politics. He was doing working class aesthetics, right? He was stepping into the space of people's actual frustration with the society that they're in. And he was playing a role. And what do you do if you're on the right and you want to play the role of creating a community amongst people of different backgrounds, right? You fill in nationalism. And the reason we are seeing this right-wing nationalist movement is because we saw across the globe, but particularly in the imperial core, a complete retreat from class politics from the traditional left parties, right? And I bring this up today. Sorry if this is long-winded, but I bring this up today because there have been a lot of debates about how we're going to get out of this swamp that we are in. How are we going to get out of this moment when we have a neoliberal resurgence and we are going to enter into a Joe Biden presidency, which is going to bring back all of the failed policies and destructive activities of decades of neoliberal retreat and particularly Democratic Party retreat from class politics? How can we confront that? The only way that we can confront that is by building a politics that seeks to recompose class as a political category. And what that means is we don't just like we can't just do that with a banner. Like we can't just do that with a slogan. We have to do this really hard work of making people, one, believe that politics can do something constructive in their life, and two, that they are members of a political class. And you just can't will yourself into that. You actually have to build that through person-to-person communication, through building organizations that are inviting people in. Like understanding that the Democratic Party in itself is a rotten husk, right, is just the first part of figuring out a way that we can build a left political movement, a left political party, a workers' party, not a resurgence of the Democratic Party, a workers' party, a workers' movement. The only way that we're going to be able to do that is by recomposing class and understanding the roles that these political parties played in decomposing class, right? No quick answers, but I just think this is an important springboard here to start thinking constructively about this question. And it's something that I think that a lot of people have been feeling very constructively about it. And what I mean by that is feeling pissed and they want to do something about it. But we have to start thinking constructively and strategically about that.
Yeah, this is kind of tangential, but I was thinking about the IDW and I think they're sort of harvesting and I think capturing a lot of this for the right wing. And what kind of stuck out to me is they will go after, for instance, professors of race or gender studies.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll also go after, like, I think George Ciccarello Marr. I don't know if that was specifically IDW people, but they'll go after them. But they don't go after Marxists as much. Like, they are very focused, at least from my perceptions, on race and gender.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they are trying to paper over. They're trying to combine the worker white men with the freaks that are in Peter Thiel's executive suite, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't go for class. You don't, because that's not the sentiment you're trying to capture. Yeah, I don't know.
That's the pivot. I mean, this is all culture war, right? The politics that we're in. And even people who are on our side, you know, they fall into that. I think, you know, to name names, like I think AOC sometimes falls into the culture war stuff, right? Of replacing class with culture, right? Replacing class with identity, right? You know, like it's bad when people do, like, trust me, like, I've been a Southern guy in New York City for a couple of years, and I'm leaving because I can't deal with it anymore. And also because I prefer Texas to here. But, you know, I've dealt with stuff like that. But, like, at the end of the day, that stuff is not, like, the real struggle in politics, right? The real struggle. And what I mean by that, by the way, is, like, classism. I was like, oh, you know, you like country music or blah, blah, blah. Like, that's white trash. And, you know, you suck. It's like, you know, that sucks. Nobody enjoys that. But, like, I'm not sitting here like, this is, like, this is the moment. Like, this is the big political fight of my time. What I do think is the big political fight of my time is that, you know, I've known throughout my whole life, just like the precarity of not being able to think 3 months ahead because you're afraid that you won't be able to pay your rent, or be able to be in the same place or be able to, you know, find food, right? Like those are very real. You know, the reality is that, you know, I've been around people my entire life who work their asses off and can never get ahead while their boss is just living, you know, an incredibly luxurious life. Like that's the oppression that, you know, in particular that really bothers me. And I think that, you know, what you've seen with the Democratic Party in particular, like running away from classes, they just have used culture to fill it in. And that's why people have such a hard time understanding, for example, what happened at the Capitol last week, because they see people with trucks and camo and they assume that they're working class, because for them, working class is a cultural identity, not a very particular economic category.
Yeah. It really is like the WASPs versus like the ruling class of everywhere else.
Yeah. I think that's exactly it. Right. I mean, it's like Ted Nugent, for example, is like a rich asshole, and also was a rich asshole before he got famous and started writing songs about, you know, getting with young girls or whatever.
Kid Rock too.
Yeah, Kid Rock too. Like these guys are well off, but they play, they don't even play. It's like, that's just like, that's their culture, right? Like their culture is to be like hunting guys, right? And to do, you know, like the stuff they like, I think is actually genuine. Yeah. It's not as much of an act as people try to make it out to be. They're just rich. And the point is like, there's a hell of a lot of rich Southern people, a lot of rich rural people out there. And it's like, it's amazing. People just like don't understand that.
Yeah, like the rich thing is, I think with hunting, right? Like you see certain people go hunting, and I do think there's some falsity to it. But guess what? Like hunting is varied. There's a lot of different type of people that go hunting, but there's also a lot of rich motherfuckers that do it because, frankly, the easiest way to go hunting is if you know rich landowners.
Yeah, exactly.
Will let you go on their land. Hunt. Yeah, exactly.
In this country.
So like there's definitely like, especially now, barriers to entry to that sort of thing. I mean, there's public lands. I mean, I know there are public lands in North Dakota and stuff like that, but like, I mean, I don't come from a wealthy family. My dad needed to network with all those fucking ranchers, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
you need to
man.
Bring them like turkeys. If you don't have just massive cash, but I assume in a lot of these other places, people are hunting where you have like older families who have been on the land for like hundreds of years. I bet you there's a lot of like, I mean, that's like where Scalia was killed at was a hunting lodge, right? Mm. Like some sort of like oligarchic Illuminati.
Yeah. Dude, I mean, come on, dude. It's like, that's like old school, like Europe shit.
Exactly. Right?
Like,
right,
you know what
exactly.
I mean? Like that's like pastoral British, you know, French, whatever, like any of those countries. Like they have those traditions.
Yeah. Right? Don't kill the king's hairs, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like this ain't some new thing. And it's like, people act like this is some new development in world history that rich people like to hunt.
It's like fucking Daniel Boone shit, which which first of all, Daniel Boone was sent there by real estate brokers himself to settle that stuff. So and lost all of his money in lawsuits and had to move to New Spain, St. Louis. Before like I mean, I don't know why I'm going on a Daniel Boone thing, but like for some reason that cultural archetype didn't even last to like leave Daniel Boone wealthy, but we still just describe it to like all these people. It's American mythology is pretty fucked up. It's really the same thing as like log cabin Republicans, and like they were like William Henry Harrison was not a guy who lived in a log cabin. I don't know.
Well, should we try to take a couple of Discord questions before
I got
we run off?
So first one from Mr. Edwin. Hi, David and Matt. As liberals treat the terror attack, we don't want to call it that, the Capitol is an excuse to buff up security, say, and show for the FBI. What can leftists say to get their liberal, normie, dim, leaning friends to not treat individual mass funding as a welcome thing. I mean, I think the thing is you have to emphasize the failure of the apparatus that's already there and the willingness of them to like allow people to get into the Capitol. Like, what are we spending? What is the Capitol Police have a budget bigger than most metropolitan forces and is unable to protect that small area? Like, that sort of it, what happened is completely consistent with defund, as far as I'm concerned.
I think that's on point.
He says like he's dealing with, you know, the more I fear that the pushback to insurrection is going to be deployed in ways that hurt the left, but the moment I bring this up, I get told that I'm a terrorist sympathizer. Yeah, yeah. I mean, those people, you need to like tell them they're the problem. We've been through this once, and like it didn't like go after the right Islamic terrorists.
I'm gonna
go ahead.
No, I think you're on point. I mean, I'm just going to say I agree with Edwin's, you know, point here, though, too. It's like, you know, there was something about that moment where it's like, yes, it was an act of desperation and all of that kind of stuff. But there is a glee that a person who holds a certain kind of politics, basically politics that are anti-revolutionary in character, gone and condemning those people with such fervor. Like, we condemn them because it's a right-wing fantasy that's completely undemocratic, right?
And will lead to something like what they want, frankly.
Yeah. You know, but like there was, you know, there is an aspect of the reaction to this that I do think is like, so like one, like the buffing up of the security state is absolutely wrong. But two, acting like, you know, protests, especially symbolic protests, you know, things like occupying places of power are inherently bad. It's like, no, like I'm going to be quite blunt about this. Like the problem with those protests was that it was, the goals, and the goals of the protest and the people of the protest.
If Joe Biden won in a landslide and Trump stole it, people would be saying, justifying that would be like, justifying like that kind of extra, like it's not nonviolent action. You're actually putting your life on the line, but it can be justified in the case of like a complete threat to democracy, which Republicans are lying about.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, like that, that's why I do think it's to emphasize that part because, the Burkean melodrama about the podium and stuff like that is the same genre, right? Like, emphasizing that is look, like, well, you need to be careful what you emphasize and stress because you could like that sort of thing about like this guy's feet are up on Pelosi's desk and the like how dare you take the podium, like. I get it. They shouldn't have been able to do that. But this is not like what was awful was that could have turned into a bloodbath where multiple people were shot. Or let's say like a staffer, like let's say from Ilhan, was caught in that rush, like would have got like ripped to shreds.
Or the reporter who just faced the horror. I mean, the stories from like one of the New York Times, like
it's not the
photographer who got caught up in that was absolutely frightening. Like that's stuff to focus on and to condemn. Like, oh, they're disrespecting the office. Like, that stuff is just, it's goofy.
Yeah.
It's goofy and wrong.
And I mean, I guess I would just, that maybe is the easiest way. Like, what if Biden won by a massive amount and then Trump and the Republicans said no?
Yeah.
What if they did that? Like, frankly, we should storm the Capitol.
Like, it was great. It was great when the American Indian movement stormed and occupied the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Like that was an important moment in history and a positive thing. And I just think that like there's a way of criticizing what happened last week that actually like sort of forces you to condemn those kind of actions as well, which I just think is the wrong attitude.
Exactly.
And when definitely a social student take, and you should also be, you know, the worry of your, you know, liberal comrades on that question as well.
Yeah. Okay. So this is from on your left. There are so many woke liberals who are actually sincere, but the problem is that many of them went through our education system, which destroyed their critical thinking skills while making them feel educated, like reading New York Times editorials is a good example. But everything they believe is propaganda and myth, but they will endlessly argue with you because they have sources. How do you cut through this? I believe a lot of these people are winnable, especially since the disaster capitalism we're dealing with. Well, Do you have anything immediately off of that, David?
Wait, I'm just trying to read it so I can follow it.
I mean, I ultimately, like, with somebody like that, I wouldn't, unless they're very close to you, I would just say be ready for a long persuasive effort. Mm-hmm. Because yes, reading the New York Times has sold them the idea that they are super informed. That's part of the reason people pay for the New York Times.
Go
ahead.
I mean, there's a big difference too between like a well-reported story and a Friedman column, though.
Right. Exactly.
And I think that there's a blurry line in most people's minds between those two things.
Yeah, you just need to be able to break down the sources. It's hard to say it in the abstract. But yeah, I don't know a general idea. I think it's just going to take a long effort, so you probably can't do it with more than a few mm-hmm. people. How likely do you think Biden's policy agenda will pass through the Senate with a 50-50 split? Seems like a giant budget reconciliation bill is the only hope to get anything substantial passed. Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be annoying. We'll see. I mean, Manchin, like, for instance, when Manchin said he's not supportive of the $2,000 checks, I think what disciplined him more than anything was the stock market, more than Joe Biden mm-hmm. or the party. So, I don't know.
It's going to be a fight.
Use it as excuse, yeah.
And it's been a couple months. It's been a couple months, since the election itself. But so what we're saying when they just fumbled the ball in November in a pretty good looking map for the Democrats that they should have done a lot better on. But yeah, I think that Samantha's 100% right, and I think that Bernie Sanders is definitely going to push, budget reconciliation as a pretty successful tactic. And there's a lot of things that the executive can do too, as we've seen from both Trump and Obama. There's tactics out there to get what you want. You just need a party that wants to do it. The reality is, just as of right now, the Democratic Party don't want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk a little bit about like, will they be forced to? Because
who's going to force them?
No. I'm saying by like, yeah, not who's going to force them, but like, so we talked about that political article you included about Biden, and they are worried about fundraising in an era post Trump, right? Like, there are weaknesses among this sort of like, Trump was very, very good for Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and yep. Joe Biden and Obama.
So, and what clues have we gotten from the Biden administration and the Democratic Party under his reign? It was announced, well, I think earlier this week, Jamie Harrison, loser from South Carolina, lost by 11%, is going to be in charge of the DNC. Again, not because he has a penchant for winning, but he has a penchant for fundraising. He broke, he broke records for money raised in a Senate race. And what's her name? Amy McGrath is another perfect example of that. That's who the Democratic Party wants. That's what they're interested in. And their fixation on 2022. If they're going to be able to hold the House and the Senate against the Republican onslaught, I don't know if it's in their calculus right now to try to win those elections or to do the kinds of things that they would need to prevent a Republican resurgence. Because again, they just they can do pretty well for themselves as a fundraising organization with Republicans in power. When the worst thing for the Democrats is actually to sit in a position where they can do something.
This is why I think it's preferable for them to be in this position from our perspective.
No, the 50-50 is great for them because they can always blame it on the Republicans.
You're right.
I think and I'm not trying to be a doomer about this. I'm just trying to get us all to start thinking strategically. It's like, we can try to force them, but like who and how and what, right? Like, definitely. I think one of the best small-time strategies that we can have in a part from trying to build working power, joining organizations, doing this kind of local work that has had significant effects, and building those networks that are going to be able to push all these people out of office, is to continue to point out the options that they have. And I think, for example, somebody like David Sirota,
is a great resource for that because he knows the ins and outs of this system well enough to say, oh, actually, when Biden says he can't do this, he 100% can. He's just not doing it.
Yeah, shout out Sirota and everybody at the Daily Poster.
Yeah, Andrew Perez and all those folks, yeah.
And also David Day and I shouldn't be blanking on his publication, but the Prospect. Day One Agenda. Yeah, oh, Prospect, yeah, yeah. America Prospect. He's got the Day One Agenda stuff. And yeah, I think that harping on that stuff is going to be very important. And we'll see how that goes. So I got a query for myself here. Matt, could you explain, this is from Seb Gorka's back pain. Matt, could you explain the American flag pin on emoji in your Twitter name and your thoughts on patriotism? I know you talked about it previously on MR, but I need a refresher thing. So I, despite the American flag emoji, I understand people's ambivalence towards a concept like patriotism. But it is an experiment that I am pursuing, which is to retake the symbols of this country for the people who actually built this country, for mm-hmm. instance, and make that look like a working class. And look, I understand this means the symbol means a lot of things to a lot of people. But just in terms of as a propagandist on Twitter, I like what it does to people when they see my messages of sort of like Marxism and like my analysis under a flag emoji. Mm-hmm. So that's, it's not a whole lot more seriously than that. I mean, I've heard distinctions between patriotism and nationalism, which is that nationalism is offensive and patriotism is defensive. And maybe you want to defend patriotism on those lines, but I don't really get that theoretical about that. I'm just kind of seeing like what happens. And I think it's kind of funny. So that's where that,
I think it's, I think it's very funny.
Deleuze for Bernie, given that we are living in the interregnum of COVID and so many political changes from the tragic loss of our big wet boy, perhaps the greatest surrealist artist of our generation, to the limited abilities to engage physically with peers, it feels a moment of bleakness is all pervading. Overdoses are rising, homelessness as well. And for many, the sole beacon is $2,000 checks. What thinkers of interruption do you look to in these times to think a logic of interruption? I personally have been reading a lot of Hegel, given his living in the interregnum of the aftermath of the French Revolution.
I'll tell you this. I think one of the best pieces on the current moment that I've read, and thanks again to Lucifer Bernie, who's a good comrade and a very insightful question. I think one of the best pieces that I have read recently has been a piece by Anton Yeager, which was published in Damage magazine. It was something along the lines of, I think it's going to take a very long time for history to begin again, which was basically talking, you know, playing with the old thesis of, you know, Fukuyama, that like history is over, and basically saying that like, okay, well, we re-entered into this moment of history, during the Trump administration, then obviously the kind of rupture that we saw through Bernie Sanders and all these other left movements. But now like COVID has reset that, because as you know, you know, there's a lot of despair, but there's also this isolation, which has just been like an actual like physical manifestation of like neoliberal ideology, in the sense, and as Anton Yeager points out, it's like everyone's at home, you're consuming by yourself, you're getting food delivered by an army of protected workers, underpaid workers. And it really has just re-cemented like a class difference and a sunset on the horizon, in the sense of like, this is a world historic moment in the sense of the coronavirus, but people's political calculus hasn't changed. And I think, and Anton Yeager, to his credit, actually wrote that like right away. And I think now, sitting here a couple, you know, just 6 days away from a Biden administration, you know, you can definitely feel that sunset is there. Now, to answer your question just very briefly, if I want to put some, you know, blood on my cheeks, I don't have the same, you know, background as the questioner does. I'll tell you who I read in moments like this. I read the doers. That's been sort of my mode these days. If I need a little inspiration, I read a little Lenin, a little Marx. You know, that gets the blood flowing again and reintroduces me to the idea that like history can
can move. I used to have a really deep love of people like Badu who have like affirmation as a part of their philosophy. But, you know, to be honest, if I needed that kind of kick in the ass, other than literature or music or things like that, if I'm going to philosophy, those are the people I'm picking up.
We have a follow-up from Deleuze for Bernie. A follow-up is, someone who teaches philosophy to undergrads, not a prof, but a grad student, mm-hmm. I often feel as if when teaching Hegel and Marx, the normative lessons are at their best serving as intellectual beacons, but in the last instance, a luxury. My colleagues remark that class consciousness and finding meaningful protest contra the capital business is eliminably a matter that the study of philosophy can elucidate. What say you two? Ought philosophy take a backseat to economics and other more practical studies? I mean, I don't agree with that at all. I think
no, I definitely I wouldn't either. I'm just saying, like, for me personally, I found what motivates me more. You know, as somebody who, like, you know, my background in philosophy is only undergrad and primarily, you know, Sartre, you know, and then obviously people who were interacting directly with Marxism, like, you know, Althusser, and those were the kind of theoretical debates that I was particularly interested in. But I don't think that's true at all. I mean, like, I think, like, to talk about something contemporary, Badu's, like, in Praise of Love, I think is one of the more interesting texts, and it's a spoken text that was transcribed, an interview actually. Is something that is just so, you know, speaks to me so much. And just to give people like an idea about this, is like, for people who aren't familiar, Alain Badiou is like one of the great, you know, French philosophers of, you know, around today, a scholar of, you know, Marx, Mao, but also Plato, and the French greats and Lacan. And anyways, like the book is like basically him walking around like modern day France and seeing all these ads for things like Tinder and freaking out. Because he argues something that I think is so true, that it's like love is a violent force. And what he means by that is like a force that interrupts your life and pulls you out of like your day to day, pulls you out of the workforce. And that's a very bad thing for capital. They want to have love. This is Badu's term, like love without the fall. Like they don't want to have that moment where you just are so human that you're not thinking about yourself as a worker, like having to go into your job and all these kinds of things. And that's why there has been such a move in capitalism to try to sell us love without the fall, right? Because it's a market relation then, or at least it's a product that is not damaging to ourselves as like subjects under capitalism, right? I bring that up to say, that's a text that's incredibly informative to me. And I think it's absolutely important. And I think that anybody who would be arguing that we don't need philosophy to inform ourselves, not just as like political militants, people trying to fight for a different kind of future. I think that that'd be wrong, but also just as like human beings. It's one thing that, mm-hmm. You know, I think engaging with the fullness of life, and if you're like inclined to read and to go into the great texts of history and philosophy and Marxism and social science, you know, to not shy away from things like philosophy, because there's so much insight, and also just like, you know, it's important to think about your place in the world and things around you and the way we communicate,
yeah,
and what history is. Like, these are questions that matter, even if they might not be like how you're going to win the next election.
And you should be, and people should be liberated to be able to pursue those sorts of questions without having to worry about getting back on the clock. Mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, in that sense, that's how I defend philosophy. Even though I didn't get super far into Hegel, although I did read a little bit of the Phenomenology.
No, I've told our friend Deleuze and Bernie, I have not yet been able to, you know, do my deep dive into Hegel. It might be a little while for me too.
Let's see, we got a couple more here. From Joe Snuffy, have you guys had a chance to check out any of the Rhode Island politics articles I've been spamming the show requests lately? Gina Raimundo is trying to flee the state and leave the wreckage of her failed COVID-19 response and disastrous economic programs in the lap of Dan McKee, Lieutenant Governor, who she has shut out of her cabinet so hard they haven't spoken. Jesus. Well, yeah, trouble in Rhode Island, talk about that. I mean, I can just say I went up to Rhode Island early on in the pandemic. Like the first time I'm like, okay, I guess I can go on like a small road trip to get out of my apartment. The place we went to was Rhode Island because they didn't have big numbers then. I'm sorry. That like a few months later they did, but not a lot of mask wearing compared to New York State when I was there. It was kind of interesting. Obviously, that's not the key response or key figure. It should be the governance, but it was just noticeable. Kowalski from Nebraska, if there are multiple states, say, protests during the inauguration, do you have more confidence in the possibility of a general strike? Thought of truckers and farmers stopping major roadways and the movement of goods while teachers and nurses go to the streets would stop the real economy and force concessions from our leaders to the working class is my hope for use inauguration. Okay, so I mean, I like the model of it, but I mean, organizing those truckers and farmers to do that would be the I think the step, right, that needs to be taken.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the tactic is correct. The power analysis is correct in the sense that, like, yeah, these folks have, these folks have a role, you know, have significant power to control the real economy. As Matt said, you know, the question is organization, and a general strike is just not something that we can proclaim. I mean, what's private unionization in the United States? Something like 6% right now. So we got a lot of work. Look that up real quick.
I mean,
6.2%. And in public sector workers is at 33.6%. I'm not saying these ideas aren't good. We just got to build it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're not like a general strike. If it does come, isn't going to come because outsiders told the unions to do it. It's going to be because a couple major unions were like, okay, this is what we need. And we need everybody on board, I think.
And there's work that has to be done within the unions to even get them there, too. Yeah. Like, you know, there's our serious reforms about the way that we categorize and organize our workers' unions in the first place. You know, but the first step is, you know, one, increasing participation. And then two, it's like the second level job is also convincing people that politics can change their lives, because that's the reality. We are living through a moment of serious depression for working people. And I mean that both politically and personally. And we have to break through that to be able to do any of these things. But I think thinking constructively about building those links between truckers and teachers is a great way to start to think seriously about those things.
Absolutely.
Oh, on that, I have to mention, because I apologize, because I meant to do Alphabet to talk about the Google union. Maybe I'll do a couple minutes on that tomorrow during the Griscom stream, and we'll try to build out some real content. Not that what I was going to say tomorrow isn't real, but like something with somebody who's a little bit involved or has, you know, particular knowledge on that too. I'll just say my top line, you know, feelings about this, like, I think building union power everywhere is good. And I think that's, you know, these being able to put democratic pressure on a powerful organization like Google is something that's going to be increasingly important, especially recognizing the monopoly powers that these organizations have. There will be some serious tensions when it comes to some culture issues that are just going to pop up with the fact of the kind of class character, or at least like the financial position of a lot of the people who are going to show up for a Google union. But these are all things that can be worked out if you have people in the same room. What I mean by that is, like, they're trying to build a wall-to-wall union, which will include, you know, like the blue-collar workers who make that system function, along with the, you know, the coders and the AI theorists and things like that, right? I think that anyone who thinks that that is a, like, there's going to be tension and there's going to be growth that will have to come from that. And I can see why some people have some skepticism. I 100% share it, because I can see, you know, just basically being a, you know, a pressure group for kind of like, you know, pretty typical young 30-year-old, late 20s kind of representational politics. But I think all those things can be pushed through. And I think that a lot of the people who are actually doing the serious organizing work recognize those threats. I'm just saying, like, any of the general criticisms that I think people on the outside have had are things that can either be overcome, because they just have to, right? If you're going to be successful, or also just might be, you know, just a kind of like thought experiment projection rather than, you know.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's not going to lead to communism, but the alternative is just what? The executives make the decisions? and tell the workers just to fuck off.
Right? That's like the, like if you're a leftist who like can't get that that's a worthwhile endeavor to understand. Like, actually, I think it's important to note that even though some you know, a lot of people in Silicon Valley make a lot of money, a lot of these people are actual like real believers and like, I'm doing technology to change the world. Like, I'm doing this to, I think that that's like a genuine feeling though. I know we make fun of tech workers, as you should, you know, a bit on the show, especially the ones with like very bloated egos. You know, most of these people are people who are highly skilled and are thinking about the future. And I think that that's a great thing and something that the left should be very comfortable tapping into to have these people think of themselves as workers challenging increasingly authoritarian system of workplace government that I know is the case at Google. So all power to the members of the Google union in this fight. I think like sometimes if you can fixate on the culture fight that we're seeing in this country, which is very annoying, we cover it on this show, we cover it on TMBS, but sometimes you can do too much of that and it poisons your brain to like literally look at something that's positive.
To the point you're like preferring decision making activity to stay centralized among bosses, right? Yeah. Like the culture stuff is a problem, but the bigger problem is that bosses have control and can command a workforce.
Exactly.
To do what they want.
I think that's it. And just before we go, because I always appreciate Kowalski's, you know, comments. He did follow up. He said, if you stop the flow of goods, everyone is in a general strike. Would it matter if you're in a union? 100% true. But to organize that stop of flow of goods, you'd have to have workers' organization. And that's what we're getting at. You know, that's the situation. But build it, man. Like we're all down for it. Like I'm down for it. I'm down to support it. I think we've seen moments and glimpses of that. I'll tell you, you know, I grew up, like a lot of my friends' parents or you know, fathers were truck drivers, and they always said that. They always were like, I could shut this whole thing down if we all stopped going to work. And honestly, that like one specific, not one, I had that conversation with a lot of people over years, but that one specific point that occurred for people all over working that profession has always been a real you know, and these guys would probably, they would not consider themselves to be progressives or anything like that. But that has always been like a real reason for my deep belief that like we can build social politics anywhere. So I agree with you, by the way, about like the possibility of these things. And I agree with you that there's the motivation. I'm just saying, you know, we can't just think about it. We have to start making that happen by doing it and also building those kind of connections with us talking about it, without talking to those people directly, like, you know, That's what I'm saying. It's like that's the next step to make these things happen.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up tonight?
No, I think this was a lot of fun. Thanks everyone so much you know, for supporting us at Patreon. Definitely check out the you know, theory reading if you haven't. We had some interesting things to cover. And you know, I'll see y'all tomorrow. Oh, yeah. And also, I think we're going to have our new song next week for everybody. So look forward to that.
New music next week, folks. All right. See you then.
All right. Take care, everyone.